Arch-Chancellor Mustrum Ridcully paused with his long-handled scrubbing brush, hovering halfway down his back, and stared around. Tiles smashed to the ground around him. Water boiled in the ornamental fountain nearby. Ridcully ducked as a stuffed badger, the origin of which was never ascertained, flew across the lawn and smashed through a window. He winced as he was hit by a brief and inexplicable shower of small cogwheels, which pattered down all around him. He stared as half a dozen watchmen dashed into the octangle and headed up the steps to the library. Then, gripping the sides of the bath, the Arch-Chancellor stood up. Foaming water cascaded off him, as it would off some ancient leviathan erupting from the abyssal sea.
"Mr. Stevens," he bellowed, his voice bouncing off the imposing walls, "where the is my hat?"
He sat down again and waited. There was a few minutes of silence, and then Ponder Stibbons, head of inadvisably applied magic and prelector of Unseen University, came running out of the main door carrying Ridcully's pointy hat. The Arch-Chancellor snatched at it and rammed it on his head.
"Very well," he said, standing up again. "Now, will care to tell at the is going on, and why old Tom Ing repeatedly?"
Magic, sir. I went up the mechanism," Ponder shouted above the sound-destroying silences.
Old Tom, the university's venerable clock, told not sounds but silences. Not simple, ordinary silences, but intervals of noise-absorbing non-sound that filled the world with loud soundlessness. There was the dying metallic noise from the big clock tower. Ponder and Ridcully waited a few moments, but the city stayed full of normal noise like the collapse of masonry and distant screams.
"Right," said Ridcully, as if grudgingly awarding the world a mark for trying. "What was all that about, Stibbons? Why are there policemen in the library?"
"A big magical storm, sir, in several thousand gigathorms. I believe that the watch is chasing a criminal."
"Well, they can't just run in here without asking," said Ridcully, stepping out of the bath and striding forward. "What do we pay our taxes for, after all?"
We don't actually pay taxes, sir," said Ponder, running after him. "The system is that we promise to pay taxes if the city ever asks us to, but provided the city promises never to ask us, sir. We make a voluntary..."
"Well, at least we have an arrangement, Stibbons."
Yes, sir. May I point out to you that you..."
"And that means they have to ask permission. The essential decencies must be maintained," said Ridcully firmly. "And I am the master of this college."
On the subject of decencies, sir, you are not, in fact, wearing..."
Ridcully strode through the open doors of the library.
"What's going on here?"
he demanded. The watchman turned and stared. A large blob of foam, which up until that point had been performing sterling service in the cause of the essential decencies, slipped slowly to the floor.
"Well," he snapped, "haven't you lot seen a wizard before?"
A watchman snapped to attention and saluted.
"Captain Carrot, sir, we've never seen so much of a wizard, sir."
Ridcully gave him the slow, blank stare used by those with acute uptake-grasping deficiency.
"What's he talking about, Stibbons?"
he said out of the corner of his mouth.
You're insufficiently dressed, sir."
"What? I've got my hat on, haven't I?"
"Yes, sir."
"Hat equals wizard. Wizard equals hat. Everything else is frippery. Anyway, I'm sure we're all men of the world,"
Ridcully added, looking around. For the first time, he took in the other details about the watchman.
"And dwarves of the world? Ah, trolls of the world, too, I see. And, women of the world, too, I note."
The Arch-Chancellor lapsed into a moment's silence and then said,
"Mr. Stibbons?"
"Yes, sir?"
"Would you be so kind as to run up to my rooms and fetch my robe?"
"Of course, sir."
"And in the meantime, please be so good as to lend me your hat."
"But, you do actually have your hat on, sir," said Ponder.
"Quite so, quite so," said Ridcully,
slowly and carefully through his fixed grin.
"And now, Mr. Stibbons, in addition, right now, I wish you, in fact, to lend to me your hat, please."
"Oh," said Ponder. Yes."
A few minutes later, a thoroughly clean and decent and clothed Arch-Chancellor was standing in the very centre of the library, staring up at the damaged dome, while beside him, Ponder Stibbons, who for some reason had elected to continue to remain hatless, even though his hat had been handed back to him, stared glumly at some magical instruments.
"Nothing at all," said Ridcully.
"Ook," said the librarian, who was an orangutan, changed from his former human shape as a result of a long-forgotten magical accident. It was so forgotten, in fact, that now people were forgetting he was an orangutan. This might seem quite hard to do, given that even a small orangutan is quite capable of filling all immediately available space, but to the wizards and most of the citizens, he was now just the librarian. And that was that. In fact, if some ever reported that there was an orangutan in the library, the wizards would probably go and ask the librarian if he'd seen it.
"You've searched everywhere!"
"And he can't search everywhere in this library, sir," said Ponder. "That would take more time than actually could possibly exist. But all the mundane shelves, certainly, Carrot turned to Ponder.
"What was he for, please, sir?"
You understand that this is a magical library, and that means that even in normal circumstances there is an area of high magical potential above the bookshelves."
"I have been here before," said Carrot.
"Then you know that time with libraries is somewhat more flexible," said Ponder. "Given the additional power of the storm, it might just be possible that
"Are you going to tell me he's been moved in time?" said the Watchman.
Ponder was impressed. He hadn't been brought up to believe that Watchmen were clever. However, he took care not to show it.
"Would that it were that simple," he said. "However, the lightning appears to have added a random lateral component."
"A what?" said Redcully.
"You mean in time and space," said Carrot.
Ponder felt himself getting rattled. Non-wizards shouldn't be that quick.
"Not exactly," he said and gave up. "I'm really going to have to work on this, Arch-Chancellor. Some of the readings I'm getting can't possibly be real."
Vimes knew that he had woken up. There had been darkness and rain and a terrible pain in his face. Then there had been another flowering of pain on the back of his neck and a feeling of being pulled this way and that. And now there was light. He could see it through his eyelids. His left eyelid, anyway. Nothing but pain was happening on the other side of his face. He kept the eyes shut and strained his hearing instead. Someone was moving about. There was a chink of metal. A woman's voice said, "He's awake."
"Are you sure?" said the man's voice. "How can you tell?"
"Because I'm good at telling if a man's asleep," said the woman. Vimes opened his eye. He was lying on a bench or table of some sort. A young woman was leaning against the wall next to him, and her dress and bearing and the way she leaned filed immediately in Vimes' policeman brain as seamstress, but one of the bright ones. The man had a long black robe and a silly floppy hat that got filed under, "Help, I'm in the hands of a doctor." He sat bolt upright.
"You lay one hand on me and I'll thump you," he yelled, trying to swing his legs off the table. Half his head burst into flame.
"I should take it easy if I were you," said the doctor, gently pushing him back. "That was a very nasty cut, and don't touch the eye patch."
"Cut,"
said Vimes, his hand brushing the stiff cloth of an eye patch. Memories interlocked.
"Car, sir. Did anyone get him?"
"Whoever attacked you got away," said the doctor.
"After that fall," said Vimes, "he must have been limping at least. Look, I've got to get..."
Then he noticed all the other things. He'd been picking him up all the time, but only now did the subconscious present the list. He wasn't wearing his own clothes.
"What's happened to my uniform?" he said.
And he noticed the "I told you so" expression the woman gave the doctor. "Whoever attacked you stripped you down to your drawers and left you lying in the street," she said. "I found you some spare clothes at my place. It's amazing what people leave behind."
"Who took my armour?"
"I never know names," said the woman. "I saw a bunch of men running off carrying stuff, though."
"Ordinary thieves, didn't they leave a receipt?"
"No," she said, laughing. "Why should they?" "And are we allowed to ask questions?" said the doctor, tidying his tools. None of this was right.
"Well, I mean, thank you, yes," said Vimes.
"What's your name?"
Vimes's hand stopped halfway to his face again.
"You mean you don't know me?" he said.
"Should we?" said the doctor. None of this was right.
"This is Ankh Morpork, isn't it?" said Vimes.
Yes, said the doctor, and turned to the woman. "There was a blow to the head," he said, "but I wouldn't have thought it was that bad."
"Look, I'm wasting time," said the woman. "Who are you, mister?"
Everyone in the city knew Vimes, surely. The Guild of Seamstresses certainly did. And the doctor didn't look stupid.
Perhaps this was not the right time to be totally truthful. He might just be somewhere where being a copper wasn't a good thing to be. It might be dangerous to be Vimes, and right now he wasn't well enough to deal with it.
Kale, he said. The name just dropped into his mind. It had been bubbling just under the surface of his thoughts all day, ever since the lilac. Yeah, right, said the woman, smiling. Want to make my first name? John, said Vimes. Appropriate. Well, John, it's like this. Men lying flat out and naked round here aren't all that uncommon. And it's a funny thing, but they don't usually want anyone to know their real name or where they live. You won't be the first one Dr. Lorne here has patched up. My name's Rosie. And now there's a little fee, you understand, for both of us? All right, all right, all right. I know how this goes, said Vimes, holding up his hands. This is the Shades, right? They both nodded. Okay, then. Thank you. I haven't got any money, obviously, but once I've got home... I'll escort you, shall I? Said the woman, handing him a badly styled coat and a pair of antique boots. I wouldn't like you to be attacked by anything. A sudden loss of memory, for example. Vimes snapped, but very gently. His face hurt, and there were plenty of other bruises everywhere, and he was dressed in a suit that smelled like a privy. He'd go up the watch house, get cleaned and changed, and make a quick report, and head on home. And this young lady could spend a night in the cells, and then be handed over to the Seamstresses Guild. They came down heavily on extortion like this. It was bad for trade. All right, he said, and he pulled the boots on. The soles were made of cardboard, and they were too tight. Dr. Lorne waved his hands in a general gesture of dismissal. "'He's all yours, Rosie. You leave that patch on for a few days, Mr. Keel, and with any luck you'll have a working eye. Someone took a slash at you with a sharp knife. I've done the best I can, and the stitching is good, but you're going to have a nasty scar.' Vimes raised his hand to his cheek yet again. "'And don't pick at it!' Lorne snapped. "'Come on, John,' said Rosie. "'Let's get you home where you belong.' They stepped out. Water was dripping from the eaves, but the rain had eased. "'I live up past Eudopolis Yard,' said Vimes. "'Lead on,' said Rosie. They hadn't reached the end of the street before Vimes was aware that a couple of dark figures had fallen in behind them. He was about to turn, but Rosie clamped a hand on his arm. "'Don't bother them, and they won't bother you,' she said. "'They're just coming with us for safety.' "'Who's yours or mine?' Rosie laughed. "'Both,' she said.
"'Yes, you just keep on walking, kind sir, and we'll be as quiet as little mice,' said a shrill voice behind him.
A slightly deeper one said,
"'That's right, dearie. Just be a good boy, and Auntie Dotsy won't have to open her handbag.'
"'That's Dotsy and Sadie,' said Vimes. "'The agony aunts. Well, they bloody well know who I am.' He turned.
The dark figures, both wearing old-fashioned black straw hoods, stepped back. In the gloom there were a number of metallic noises, and Vimes forced himself to relax a little. Even though they were, more or less, on the same side as the watch, you never quite knew where you were with the agony aunts. Of course, that's what made them so useful. Any customer disturbing the peace in one of the local houses of good repute feared the threat of the aunts far more than he did the watch. The watch had rules, and the watch didn't have Dotsy's handbag, and Sadie could do terrible things with a parrot-headed umbrella.
"'Come on,' he said. "'Dotsy, Sadie, that's not mess about, eh?'
Something prodded him in the chest. He looked down. The thing had a carved parrot head on it.
"'You must keep walking, kind sir,' said a voice. "'Why, you've still got toes, dearie,' said another voice.
"'Probably a good idea,' said Rosie, tugging Vimes's arm. "'But I can tell you've impressed them.'
"'Ow!
You're not bent double and making bubbling noises. "'Come along, mystery man.'
Vimes stared ahead, looking out for the blue light of Pseudopolis Yard. Somehow it'd all make sense there. But when he got there, there was no blue light over the archway. There were just a few lights upstairs. Vimes hammered on the door until it opened a crack.
"'What the hell's going on here?' he demanded, to the nose and one eye that was the visible totality of the occupant. "'And get out of the way!'
He pushed the door back and strode in. It wasn't the watch house, not inside. There were the familiar stairs right enough, but there was a wall right across the charge room, and carpets on the floor, and tapestries on the wall, and a housemaid holding a tray, and staring, and dropping the tray, and screaming.
"'Where are all my officers?'
Vimes yelled.
"'You leave this minute, do you hear? You can't just come in like that. You get out of here!'
Vimes turned and confronted the old man who'd opened the door. He looked like a butler, and had picked up a cudgel. Perhaps because of nerves, or maybe just because of general elderly tremors, the tip of the cudgel waved and weaved under his nose. Vimes snatched it and threw it on the floor.
"'What is going on?' he demanded.
The old man looked as bewildered as he was. Vimes felt an odd, hollow terror welling up inside him. He darted back through the open door and into the wet night. Rosie and the aunts had melted away in the darkness, as night people do when trouble looms, but Vimes ran on and into King's Way, pushing aside other pedestrians and dodging the occasional carriage. He was getting a second wind when he reached Schoon Avenue and turned into the driveway at number one. He wasn't sure what he'd find, but the place looked normal and there were torches burning on either side of the door. Familiar gravel crunched under his feet. He went to hammer on the door, but steeled himself not to and rang the bell instead. After a moment, the door was opened by a butler.
"Thank goodness," said Vimes. "It's me, man. Been in a fight. Nothing to worry about. How is—"
"What do you want?"
said the butler coldly. He took a step back, bringing him more fully in the light of the hall lamps. Vimes had never seen him before.
"What happened to Willikins?" said Vimes.
"The scullery boy."
Now the butler's tone was icy.
"If you are a relative, I suggest you inquire around at the tradesman's entrance. You ought to know better than to come to the front door."
Vimes tried to think how to deal with this, but his fist didn't bother to wait. It laid the man out quite cleanly.
"No time for this," said Vimes, stepping over him.
He stood in the middle of the big hall and cupped his hands.
"Mrs. Content? Sybil?" he yelled,
feeling the terror twist and knot inside him.
"Yes?"
said a voice from what Vimes had always called the ghastly pink drawing room, and Sybil stepped out. It was Sybil. The voice was right, and the eyes were right. And the way she stood was right. But the age wasn't right. This was a girl far too young to be Sybil. She looked from him to the prone butler.
"Did you do that to Forsyth?" she said.
There's been a mistake,"
Vimes murmured, backing away. But Sybil was already pulling a sword off the wall. It wasn't there for show. Vimes couldn't remember if his wife had ever learned to fence, but several feet of edged weapon is quite threatening enough when wielded by an angry amateur. Amateurs sometimes get lucky. He backed away hurriedly.
"It's been a mistake. Wrong house. Mistaken identity."
He almost tripped over the fallen butler, but managed to turn this into a staggering run through the doorway and down the steps. Wet leaves brushed against him as he blundered through the shrubbery to the gateway, where he leaned against the wall and gulped for air.
That bloody library. Hadn't he heard something once about how he could walk through time or something there? All those magical books pressed together did something strange. Sybil had been so young. She looked 16. No wonder there wasn't a watch house in Pseudopolis Yard. They'd only moved in there a few years ago.
The water was soaking through the cheap clothes. Back home somewhere was his huge leather greatcoat, heavy with oil, warm as toast. Think, think. Don't let the terror take control. Perhaps he could go and explain things to Sybil. After all, she was still Sybil, wasn't she? Kind to bedraggled creatures. But even the softest heart would be inclined to harden when a rough, desperate man with a fresh scar and bad clothes barged into the house and said he was going to be your husband. A young woman could get quite the wrong idea, and he wouldn't want that, not while she was holding a sword. Besides, Lord Ramkin was probably still alive, and he'd been a bloodthirsty old devil as far as Vimes could recall. He slumped against the wall and reached for a cigar, and the terror twisted him again. There was nothing in his pocket, nothing at all. No pantweed slim panatellas, but more importantly, no cigar case. It had been especially made. It had a slight curve. It had always nestled in his pocket since the day Sybil had given it to him. It was as near part of him as anything could be. We are here, and this is now. Constable Visit, a strict believer in the Omnium religion, occasionally quoted that from their holy book. Vimes understood it to mean, in less exalted copper speak, that you have to do the job that is in front of you. I am here, Vimes thought, and this is then. Unless conscious parts of this brain added, you have no friends here, no home here, no purpose here. You are alone here. No, not alone, said a part that was much, much deeper even than the terror, and was always on watch. Someone was watching him. A figure detached itself from the damp shadows of the street and walked towards him. Vimes couldn't make out the face, but that didn't matter. He knew it would be smiling, that special smile of the predator who knows he has the prey under his paw, and knows that the prey knows this too, and also knows that the prey is desperately going to act as if they're having a perfectly friendly conversation, because the prey wants so much for this to be the case. "You don't want to die here," said the deep, dark part of Vimes's soul.
"'Got a light, mister?' said the Predator. He didn't even bother to wave an unlit cigarette. "'Why, yes, of course,' said Vimes. He went as if to pat his pocket, but swung around, arm outstretched, and caught a man creeping up behind him right across the ear. Then he leapt for the light demander in front of him and bore him to the ground with an arm across his throat. It would have worked. He knew afterwards that it really would have worked. If there hadn't been two more men in the shadows, it would have worked. As it was, he managed to kick one of them on the kneecap before he felt the garrote go round his neck. He was pulled upright, the scar screaming pain as he tried to clutch at the rope. "'You old dim right there,' said a voice. "'Look what he did to Jez. Damn, I'm going to kick him in.' The shadows moved. Vimes, struggling for breath, his one good eye watering, was only vaguely aware of what was happening. But there were some grunts and some soft, strange noises, and the pressure on his neck was abruptly released. He fell forward and then, reeling a little, struggled to his feet. A couple of men were lying on the ground. One was bent double, making little bubbling noises. And far off and getting further, there were running footsteps.
"'Lucky we found you in time, kind sir,' said a voice right behind him. "'Not lucky for Sam, dearie,' said the one right next to it.
Rosie stepped forward out of the gloom. "'I think you ought to come back with us,' she said. "'You're going to get hurt, running around like this. Come on. Obviously I'm not taking you back to my place.'
"'Obviously,' murmured Vimes.
"'But Mossy'll find you somewhere to lay your head, I expect.'
"'Mossy Lawn?' said Vimes, suddenly light-headed. "'That's him! The pox doctor! I remember!'
He tried to focus one tired eye on the young woman. "'Yes, the bone structure was right. That chin. That was a no-nonsense chin. It was a chin that took people somewhere.
"'Rosie? You're Mrs. Palm!'
"'Mrs.?' she said coldly, while the agony aunts giggled their high-pitched giggle.
"'I think not!'
"'Well, I mean,' Vimes floundered. "'And I've never seen you before,' said Rosie. "'And neither have Dotsie and Sadie, and they have an amazing memory for faces. "'But you act as if you own a place, John Keel.'
"'Do I?'
"'You do. It's the way you stand. "'Officers stand like that. "'You eat well. Maybe a bit too well. "'You could lose a few pounds. "'And then there's the scars all over you. "'I saw them in Mossy's place. "'Your legs are tanned from the knees down, and that says watchman to me.' "'because they go bare-legged. "'But I know every watchman in the city, "'and you're not one of them, "'so maybe you're a military man. "'You fight by instinct, and dirty too. "'That means you're used to fighting for your life in a melee, "'and that's odd, "'because that says to me foot soldier, not officer. "'The word is that the lads took some fine armour off you. "'That's officer. "'But you don't wear rings. "'That's foot soldier. "'Rings catch in things. "'Can pull your finger off if you're not careful.' "'And you're married. "'How can you tell that?'
"'Any woman could tell that,' said Rosie Palm smoothly. "'Now, step sharp. "'We're out after curfew as it is. "'The watch won't bother much about us, but they will about you.'
"'Curfew,' thought Vimes. "'That was a long time ago. "'Veterinari never ordered curfews. "'They interfered with business.
"'I think perhaps I lost my memory when I was attacked,' he said.
"'That sounded good,' he thought. "'What he really needed now was somewhere quiet to think.'
"'Really? I think perhaps I'm the Queen of Hershebar,' said Rosie. "'Just remember, kind sir, I'm not doing this because I'm interested in you, "'although I'd admit to a macabre fascination about how long you're going to survive. "'If it hadn't been a cold, wet night, I'd have left you in the road. "'I'm a working girl, and I don't need trouble. "'But you look like a man who can lay his hands on a few dollars, "'and there will be a bill.'
"'I'll leave the money on the dressing table,' said Vimes. "'The slap in the face knocked him against the wall.'
"'Consider that a sign of my complete lack of a sense of humour, will you?' said Rosie, shaking some life back into her hand.
"'I'm sorry,' said Vimes. "'I didn't mean to... I mean... Look, thank you for everything, I mean it. But this is not being a good night.'
"'Yes, I can see that.
"'It's worse than you think, believe me.'
"'We all have our troubles, believe me,' said Rosie.
Vimes was glad of the agony aunts behind them as they walked back to the shades. This was the old shades, and Lawn lived a street's width away from it. The watch never set foot here. In truth, the new shades wasn't a lot better, but people had at least learned what happened if anyone attacked a watchman. The aunts were a different matter. No one attacked the aunts. A night's sleep, thought Vimes. Maybe in the morning this won't have happened.
She wasn't there, was she? Said Rosie after a while.
Your wife. That was Lord Ramkin's house. Are you in trouble with him?
"'Never met the man,' said Vimes absently.
You were lucky someone told us where you'd gone. Those men were probably in the pay of someone up there. They're a law unto themselves over in Ankh. Some rough man walking around with no tradesman's tools, well, he's to be turned off the patch. And if they rob you blind while they're doing it, who's going to care? Yes, thought Vimes, that's the way it was. Privilege, which just means private law. Two types of people laugh at the law, those that break it and those that make it. Well, it's not like that now. But I'm not in now. Damn those wizards. The wizards, right. In the morning I'll go and explain, easy. They'll understand. I bet they can send me right back to where I left. There's a whole university full of people to deal with this. It's not my problem any more. Relief filled his body like a warm pink mist. All he had to do was get through the night. But why wait? They were open all night, weren't they? Magic didn't shut. Vimes remembered late-night patrols when he could practically see by the glows coming from some of the windows. He could simply... Hold on. A policeman's thought had been stirring in his mind. The aunts didn't run. They famously didn't run. They caught up with you slowly. Anyone who'd been, as they called it, a very naughty boy, would sleep extremely badly knowing that the aunts on his tail were slowly getting nearer, pausing only for a cream tea somewhere or to visit an interesting jumble sale. But Vimes had run all the way up to Schoon Avenue, in the dark, through coach traffic and crowds of people worming home before curfew. No one had paid him any attention. Would surely not have seen his face if they did. And he certainly didn't know anyone here. He amended the thought. No one knew him. So, he said casually, who told you where I'd gone? Oh, one of those old monks, said Rosie. Which old monks? Who knows? A little bald man with a robe and a broom. There's always monks begging and chanting somewhere. He was in Feeder Road. And you asked him where I'd gone? What? No. He just looked round and said, Mr. Keel ran up to Schoon Avenue. Then he went on sweeping. Sweeping? Oh, it's the kind of holy thing they do, so they don't tread on ants, I think. Or they sweep sins away, or maybe they just like the place clean. Who cares what monks do? And nothing about that struck you as odd? Why? I thought perhaps you were naturally kind of beggars, snapped Rosie. Doesn't bother me. Dotsy said she put something in his begging bowl, though. What? Would you ask? The majority of Vimes thought, who does care about what monks do? They're monks. That's why they're weird. Maybe one had a moment of revelation or something. They like that kind of thing. So what? Find the wizards. Explain what's happened and leave it to them. But the policeman part thought, how do little monks know I'm called Keel? I smell a rat. The majority said, it's a 30-year-old rat then. And the policeman said, yeah, that's why it smells. Look, I'm going to have to go and check something, he said. I'll probably be back. Well, I can't chain you up, said Rosie. She smiled a grim little smile and went on, that costs extra. But if you don't come back, yet have any intention of staying in this city, then the aunts... I promise you, the last thing I want to do is leave Ankh-Morpork, Pork, said Vimes. That actually sounded convincing, said Rosie. Off you go, then. We're past curfew now, but why don't I think you'll be bothered by that? As he disappeared in the gloom, Dotsy sidled up to Rosie.
Do you want we should follow him, dearie?
Don't bother.
You should have let Sadie give him a little prod, dear. That slows them down.
I think it takes quite a lot to slow that man down. And we don't want trouble. Not at a time like this. We're too close.